Norm Lynn, who's the head trader up in Merrimack, New Hampshire, where our fixed money market desk, and another trader that works with him, Kevin Gaffney. Kevin Mahar is a lawyer who works with me, who's actually calling in from the airport, who'll probably have to drop off at some point. So when we spoke, Brad Bondi was involved in the conversation, Tom. You and Mina had asked some questions about a couple of different things. Broadly speaking, the repo market was a topic of
yes.
conversation. And you tell me, but I thought it made sense to sort of let you open it up with some questions. Norm and Kevin have got a lot of experience in this area. If you want to follow up with conversations about data or backup, we're more than happy to do that. But it sounds like we may be able to help you get a sense of where you're going and give you some guidance here as to sort of on the ground what we saw happening over the last couple of years.
Well, thank you so much. Part of our mission here is to look at shadow banking, and to that end, we're looking at the repo market, and we're looking at the commercial paper market, and we're looking also at the investments made by money market mutual funds. And the extent to which various organizations were involved either with Bear Stearns or with Lehman Brothers. We are particularly interested in three time periods. July and August of 2007, March of 2008, and September of 2008. And while I know it was not within the ambit of our original discussion, Scott, I would appreciate it to the extent that your folks there have a feel for what happened in the commercial paper market, that they feel free to express that to us in this conversation. First off, I guess let's just get it started. How do you go about trading repos?
Hi, guys. This is Norm Lind. As Scott said, I'm head trader up here, and Kevin Gaffney is with me, heads up our repo desk. I assume you're asking from the standpoint of why do we find it appealing, or what are the mechanics? How do we actually go about executing in that market?
Well, actually, I'm asking both questions. I want to know the answers to both of those. I mean, why is it appealing to you? And then secondly, how does a person that steps into your desk go ahead and effect a transaction on a given day?
Okay, fair enough. I'll take the first part and Kevin take the second. We have approximately $500 billion in money market assets up here at Fidelity. So we use ourselves as the example. I think we're typical of a lot of the money market participants in the repo market. We have funds that are looking every day for investments in the short-term market. And as you can imagine, what we're trying to do is find those investments that are the highest quality, that are liquid, that represent minimal credit risk, and we know that we can get our money back quickly for our shareholders. We are money market funds, so shareholders can withdraw at any time. We find the repo market attractive because the participants in the marketplace are high quality and are the type of counterparties that are appealing to us to trade with. Now, one thing that's important to know, particularly about us as money market funds, we look at these trades from the standpoint of the issuer themselves. So, for example, we look at J.P. Morgan, and they offer to do a repo transaction with us at a certain yield. We look at all the transactions in the marketplace along the entire curve, determine that one to be attractive. We're allowed to do that trade, and we find that trade appealing because J.P. Morgan represents minimal credit risk. In other words, they represent a counterpart that we find to be of the highest credit quality and that we will transact with.
Right.
The collateral itself, while a nice addition to the trade and makes the trade even more secure because we have collateral backing it, is not the impetus.
Now departing.
Kevin Mahar. Is not the impetus for doing the trade for us. We look at it as we have a trade available with a high-quality counterpart, J.P. Morgan, at a yield that's very attractive to our portfolios that happens to be in the repo market as we look at the entire landscape of potential investments in the short-term market. And what we're counting on when we do that trade is J.P. Morgan will go into that trade with us, and tomorrow or 7 days from now, 14 days from now, whatever the term of that repo trade is set at, we expect J.P. Morgan to give us our money back. And that's what we're counting on. We're not looking at the collateral. We're not thinking about the collateral in terms of we're going to get that back and that's going to be the security for the transaction. We understand the collateral. We evaluate it. We do all the things we're supposed to as prudent investors. But for us, the main reason for doing the trade is it's offered by J.P. Morgan, and it's at a rate and a maturity that's very attractive to our portfolios. So when we think about why we invest in the repo market, it's just one component of the entire landscape of securities that we see in our marketplace for us to invest in, whether it be government securities, treasury securities, commercial paper, certificates of deposit, or the repo market. We're looking across that landscape at which securities provide us liquidity, the exposure on the yield curve, and the type of quality investment and the yield that we're looking for that portfolio. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Norm, sometimes bad things happen to good people. And you may find that the counterparty credit quality changes. What types of collateral typically do you take in these repo agreements?
The most typical type of collateral we take in these arrangements are government collateral. The majority of the trades that we do are in treasury securities and other government securities, meaning agencies and mortgage-backed agency type paper. We also do other types of collateral with these counterparts. So we will do a transaction, again, with a very high-quality counterpart in securities such as corporate bonds or equities that might actually be backing the trade, but that's a smaller portion of what we do. And again, you know, we're trying to keep these very short so that we have confidence, that we have visibility on the credit quality of that issuer, that hopefully those bad types of things you're talking about don't happen while we're part of that trade and we own that trade with that counterpart.
Norm,
if for some reason the counterpart no longer was minimal credit risk for us, or we no longer looked at that as being a high quality counterpart for us to invest with, then we would no longer transact with that counterpart, no matter what types of collateral was backing it. But as I said, the collateral is there. We know it. It's important to us. We do look at it. But it's not the reason for doing the trade. But those are really the main types of collateral we look at doing.
Well, I mean, you described yourself as a fairly typical, but I think $500 billion in money market assets is a little atypical.
That's a good point. I don't think of ourselves as typical as far as our size in the marketplace overall, but I think we're typical of the money market funds in that how we look at the counterparts, how we look at the market, and how we evaluate why we would go into a repo trade.
Well, you said the most of your collateral would be treasuries or agency securities. Can you break down kind of by rough percentages how they fit into the categories of collateral, and then also talk about whether or not the types of collateral that were accepted has changed during 07, 08, and now, 09?
The general breakdown is about 75 to 80% of the collateral that we do is government collateral, that being the agency collateral and the treasury collateral that I talked about. That leaves about 20 to 25% of it currently in other types of securities, what we call non-traditional repo, which is away from the government type securities that we trade in.
Okay. Did that mix change, you know, when Bear was being sold, when Lehman went under?
It did. When things went on, we're going with Bear and with Lehman and some other counterparts out there, we had a little bit less demand for repo overall, and we did curtail the non-traditional part of the program. The market was feeling shaky. One of the reasons that one of the important attributes for this collateral is you want to make sure that it's always priced at a way that covers your overall liability that they have to you. So you're looking at the collateral basket as being equal and slightly higher than the overall loan amount. There's always been a haircut on all the collateral that's been done on the repo platform, and that haircut can differ depending on the type of collateral that you're doing. In 07 and into 08, what happened was the price volatility became so great on a lot of the non-traditional repo, so things like corporate bonds and things in the marketplace, that it was really hard to know what the haircut needed to be to cover you for any kind of price volatility in the marketplace, and it was just more prudent for us to step away from that part of the market. So at that point, so you talk about late 07 and in 2008, we really did cut back to the point of doing mostly Treasury and government securities. We still had some counterparts and some pieces of the non-traditional we did, but it was in those sectors that we felt better about the our ability to see the pricing, and the volatility of pricing wasn't as dramatic.
Well, I mean,
we did tear back, and then as markets have stabilized some, we've expanded that back out a little bit.
I know that, and you know, we read in House of Cards where Fidelity Investments, the mutual fund giant based in Boston, had been lending Bear Stearns $6 billion a day, every day. But that week, Fidelity pulled its overnight funding. Was that typical at your point, with that you were mostly in overnights as opposed to differing term? And at the time,
yeah.
What was the collateral that you were concerned about there?
Again, we weren't concerned about the collateral in that trade with Bear Stearns itself. We were concerned about Bear Stearns' creditworthiness overall. So we looked to our credit analyst, because that's where the decision always starts here at our shop. And the credit analyst makes a determination as to whether a counterpart meets minimal credit risk, as is required by the SEC regulations under Rule 287. We take a look at our counterparts, and if a counterpart meets minimal credit risk, then they're a worthy investment for us. And we make a determination on what type of investment we want to do with them. If they don't meet minimal credit risk, and our analyst is becoming concerned about their ability to repay us any loan at all, we will take them off our list of qualified investment counterparts and not trade with them any longer. And that's what happened with Bear Stearns.
Is that a binary thing, or did you slowly reduce your exposure and then pull the plug?
What will often happen is that the analyst might look at a counterpart and say, you know, I don't have as much visibility as I used to. So it might be, and this is just an example, but it might be that a particular counterpart that we're doing business with, we have a six-month window on. So we're allowed to invest out to 6 months in that particular counterpart. If they feel like they're losing some visibility on it, or they don't have as much certainty over that long a time frame, they'll pull that in. So it might then pull down to 30 days or even 7 days as far as how long our funds can have an investment in that security, how long dated an investment can be with that counterpart.
So had you previously made that decision with Bear Stearns?
I'm sorry?
So had you previously made that decision with Bear Stearns? Was it already kind of on that watch list?
Yeah, so it had come down. We had lowered our dollar limit. Our analyst set the guideline on how much exposure we can have to any one particular counterpart, and based on their ability to repay, and then how long that maturity can be based on that analyst's visibility to that credit. And they had been bringing Bear Stearns in for a while as the volatility was starting to hit the market and some concerns being raised about Bear Stearns. So the limit had come down, the days of maturity had come down before it actually came off of our list of qualified investments, and we could no longer invest with Bear Stearns.
You use the term call it in. What does that mean in this context?
I'm sorry, I said pull it in. So they were pulling in that days to duration. So what I was saying is that if at one point, we were allowed to invest 90 days in a particular security, and now it's down to 30 days. I just meant that we were pulling in the maturity limit that we had on that security.
Yes, thank you. I understand.
Do you want to talk about the actual mechanics of how we go about trading?
Yes, very much so.
Okay, I'll turn it over to Kevin. He can talk about how we do that every day.
Thank you, Norm.
Sure, thanks. I think as Norm had mentioned, first off, before we trade with any counterpart, we go through a whole credit determination. Our credit analysts make sure that the counterpart represents minimal credit risk as is required through SEC Rule 287. And once they meet that hurdle and we've had conversations with them, we have internal contracts that are negotiated between both sides. We do all of our domestic repo via the tri-party platform. So we use either one of the two tri-party banks, J.P. Morgan or Bank of New York, depending upon the counterpart where their assets reside. So once we have a contract in place that's signed off by legal and all operational that's signed off and research has signed off, we can begin to trade with them. And basically, as Norm was saying, we, you know, because our funds require a lot of liquidity, we have a lot of cash to spend on a daily basis and a lot of cash that we spend in very short-term instruments to maintain that liquidity. The repo market is probably the deepest market for liquid investments for money market funds. As you're aware, that the market, as recently as a couple of years ago, was north of $4 trillion, $4.5 trillion, I think it was, about 2 years ago. And so that is a market that we utilize very heavily every day. We utilize it across collateral spectrums with the majority of it, as Norm said, in the government space. So if we have a an approved counterpart that we have contracts in place with.
Sorry, when you say a contract in place, do you mean is it just a master agreement or is there other documentation?
Yeah, so it's a master repurchase agreement. We don't use the standard form. We have our own proprietary repo contract that we sign that our legal group has approved for us. But you're correct. It's like a repo master repurchase agreement.
Okay. And what are the key kind of terms of those contracts?
You know, it's probably better, the question is probably better suited for Kevin Mahar.
This is Scott Goldblatt. We're happy to sort of try to give you an answer to that offline. The answer is, I mean, these contracts are quite complicated. The terms are quite extensive, and they have to deal with both the amount of collateral, how you settle collateral, the indemnifications that run back and forth. There's sort of typical commercial contracts in theory, but there's a lot of detail around settlement and setting off and what the mechanics are in the case something goes wrong, as you might imagine. So we can give you more detail about how these things work, but that's probably better to do either with an email or some other way.
Sure.
We're happy to do that.
That's perfectly acceptable. Thank you.
Sorry, just one quick question. Is the subject matter covered by your contract generally the same as the master, kind of the global agreement that's out there? It's just that you choose to handle certain things differently? Or
yeah, we're big enough that we can negotiate more favorable terms, but the general areas that are covered are the same as those you'd see in the standard contracts.
Oh, great. Thanks.
One issue that we've had a great deal of difficulty locating is determining the size of the repo market. And you use the $4.5 trillion market size with reference to a couple of years ago. Where do you go about finding the data that can tell you the size of the repo market in any given week or day or quarter or month?
Yeah, so it's a very good question because I think a lot of times it's misquoted. I don't think it's a very easy number to get to, but I think the most consistent place to get it, and I found that the most accurate, is on the New York Fed's website. On a weekly basis, they post the financing activity of the primary dealer community. All the primary dealers that make up, you know, within the New York Fed. And so they post that on a weekly basis. I believe it comes out on Wednesdays. It gives a whole bunch of detail, but there's a section that talks about the repurchase activity of primary dealers. And they have the repo and reverse repo categories on an overnight and continuing, which is overnight and overnight roll type activity, and also on a term basis. And so you know, I look at the combination of those two as the size of the repo market, as you know, which really concerns us, is that side of the repo market.
Would those numbers be available both for bilateral and tri-party repo agreements?
I don't think they break it out for both. You know, I've done some work in trying to isolate exactly which one is tri-party and you know, what part of it's tri-party and what part of it's bilateral. Right now, though, the market's just over $2.4 trillion. My estimate is that the tri-party is just under $2 trillion. So the
the bilateral is probably somewhere in that $400 to $500 billion range.
But is it your understanding that the New York Fed website data contains the aggregate number for bilateral and tri-party repos?
Yes.
Good. Super.
So your dealings in the repo market are entirely with the primary dealers?
Not entirely with the primary dealers, but I would say over 90-95% is with the primary dealers.
So the rest would be what, overseas or?
There are some foreign, large foreign banks that for one reason or another are just not primary dealers. But I would say the list of primary dealers, we are probably active in about 80% of them. And there might be a couple names that aren't primary dealers that we are active in.
And almost everything we do is on the tri-party platform. Yes.
Was that true 2 years ago, or is the tri-party platform really taken off?
The platform has definitely taken off. It's very efficient. You really limit the amount of cash that you're moving back and forth. The securities reside at the tri-party bank. They're not being delivered back and forth. So to answer your question, 10 years ago, I'd say probably 20% of our book was done via, bilateral deliverable repo, two-party repo, and 80% of it was tri-party, and now it's, as Norm said, domestically it's 100%. The only bilateral two-party repo we do is in Canadian dollars.
And I don't know if you asked if it was 2 years ago or 10 years ago, but 2 years ago it was still all on the tri-party platform.
Yeah.
It was really, as Kevin said, 10 years ago we did still do some bilateral, but since then it's really become almost all tri-party for at least the past 5 or 6 years.
Oh, so throughout this crisis you were already doing mostly tri-party.
Yes.
And if tri-party is now $2 trillion out of a $2.4 trillion market wide, was that also true 2 years ago? The market was mostly tri-party?
Yes, that is true.
I didn't really understand.
Go ahead.
I think you kind of touched on, but can you maybe just explain in a little more detail why you chosen to use the tri-party platform rather than doing bilateral repos?
Well, to start on the efficiencies, our repo book varies in size, but it's roughly about $150 billion right now. To do bilateral repo, where we're getting delivery of underlying collateral pieces one by one, you might have a $2 or $3 billion repo trade on with J.P. Morgan. There might be hundreds of underlying pieces of collateral for that particular trade. We'd have to receive delivery in of every specific piece of collateral versus payment on that. So by centralizing everything at the tri-party bank, and the tri-party bank's doing all the pricing for both counters, both sides, they're moving cash back and forth because they have accounts in both our name and our counterparts' names. The collateral doesn't have to move. The cash just can sit there and go back and forth. The efficiencies are just, much too great for us to consider not to do that.
So in that circumstance, J.P. Morgan is your agent for purposes of taking collateral and receiving payments?
J.P. Morgan, the tri-party bank, yes. In the instance that we're entering into a repo transaction with the broker-dealer sub of J.P. Morgan, yes, you're correct.
But there is, I think you understand, the tri-party market, there are two main tri-party providers, and that we're on both platforms, J.P. Morgan and Bank of New York.
So is it probably true that the people who would tend to do bilateral repos would have a much smaller interest in the repo market than you all do, such that, maybe it's not so unwieldy for them to collect 10 bonds as collateral?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that you'll find that the participation in bilateral repo or two-party repo is usually just because there is an upfront cost that's associated with having getting all the links all lined up for the tri-party platform, but so a lot of smaller participants do two-party.
It has been suggested by one or more writers that the increase in the haircuts may be harbingers, or as you put it, the canary in the coal mine, of difficult times coming. Have you experienced that? Is that your experience as well?
As far as, well, I think it's one of those questions, you know, why would, you know, first off, we didn't see a significant increase in haircuts going into Bear or going into Lehman. I know that away from us, there were certain counterparts that did that. And I think for us, it relates back to what Norm said earlier, is that we're looking strictly at the counterpart. We're not relying on the collateral to get us our cash back. And once we feel as if the counterpart is no longer representing minimal credit risk, we're not going to raise the haircut to make us feel better. We're going to limit our exposure or eliminate our exposure.
Now, there really are different types of participants on this platform. For example, if you go to a large money center bank, like, say, Bank of America, for example, they're going to do repo transactions with counterparts that we wouldn't. They might do it with hedge funds. They might do it with different types of counterparts out there. Now, they spend a lot of time looking at both the counterpart and the collateral itself. They're valuing the collateral and thinking of it as pure security for this trade and thinking in terms of, all right, what's this trade worth to us, assuming that we have to take this collateral in?
Yeah.
We're doing it from a different perspective. We're looking at that counterpart saying, we are evaluating that money, that counterpart. Are they money good? Are they minimal credit risk? Do they meet the requirements that we have, and do we put that trade on with them? And the collateral, although important because it's there and it's available to us in time of crisis, is secondary in that trade determination. So we're not spending a lot of time on the haircut determination. The haircuts we do are fairly standardized with our counterparts. While Bank of America, the example I was using, they are looking for collateral, so it's very important to them to set that haircut at what they think is an appropriate level to insulate themselves. So it's two different ways of thinking of the trade, and we're really, we're really put in a position of thinking of it in a very specific way, because again, the rules that govern money market funds tell us how we have to look at a counterpart and how we determine whether or not, that we need to look at that counterpart and make that determination that that counterparty is minimal credit risk, and we are going into that trade looking to them solely as providing repayment on that loan.
So how do the different incentives that you face versus a money center bank affect your behavior, you know, during a crisis when folks start to really focus on a name like Bear Stearns?
I'm sorry, say it again.
How does the different incentives, the different rules that you have versus the money center banks affect how you would handle the growing risk that would in a certain name? I mean, it sounds like over time, Bank of America might be more likely to gradually increase the haircut, and then possibly cut off a Bear Stearns, whereas you have a different approach. So I'm just saying, I'm wondering if there's a systemic risk there that might be more with different types of counterparties.
If I understand your question correctly, I think that the behavior that you would have as far as the lenders like ourselves on the platform go, mm-hmm. are they, you know, if we see a counterpart deteriorate or not meet our credit standards any longer, we will cease doing business with that counterpart, just like we would in any other market that we face off with them.
Mm-hmm.
While the Bank of America example, or someone who's looking to collateral, might balance the collateral and the counterpart and be more willing to stay in that trade because they are looking to take the collateral in. You have to remember that even on a treasury transaction, the collateral that's backing the trade is most likely longer dated paper. It might be 2 year, 3 year, 5 year treasury notes, very high quality, but nothing that we can actually own in our portfolios or take in. It's merely they're backing that trade, and we're looking to that counterpart to give us the money back in the time, you know, we've designated for that trade.
Do you know about what portion of the repo market is made up of money market funds versus banks, other players?
We've asked that question because we've had some conversations, you know, with the policymakers and also with the tri-party banks. We're hearing it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 25%.
What's that?
25-30% would be the money market funds.
Would ICI be a repository of that type of information, you think?
They very well could be. They might have that information. I think they would go to some of the same sources we did, but they might have done more digging into it than we have. So they very well could be.
So when you mentioned that haircuts are going up, is that something that's transparent to you as a market participant? Do you know when that's happening?
As far as haircuts, I guess you're saying if other lenders are raising their haircuts
right.
to a Bear Stearns?
Right.
No, that's not necessarily transparent to us.
It's not. I mean, there's really no way, there's no visibility in seeing where haircuts are. It's just really here.
I mean, is that a problem with the market? Is that something that would be useful to know?
I mean, I think having visibility. I mean, I think everybody's going to have different haircuts. I know that there's been talk about standardizing haircuts, and I think along certain asset classes there is kind of a standardized haircut. You know, so for instance, for treasuries, I think it's 1-2% is standard. I think it's tough to standardize haircuts across collateral types and counterparts because every counterpart's different.
Mm-hmm.
And that is being discussed. You're probably aware the New York Fed has a tri-party repo task force that mm-hmm. they are sponsoring that's working on this issue. And one of the questions they're asking, that the task force is asking, is should there be some kind of standardized haircuts? And how should haircuts be set? So I know there's a lot of work being done in that area.
Yeah, we have seen some of their preliminary articles.
Yeah.
Norm, it's Scott Goble, Norm and Kevin. Do you think that the flip side of standardizing the haircuts, or at least publicizing maybe the haircuts, it could exacerbate systemic risk by when one entity moves to increase the haircut, that sends a signal into the marketplace that might otherwise go undetected and not cause collateral moves by other shops?
I guess that depends on how they could publicize it. I think what a lot of the conversation at the task force has been around is what should be the standard haircut based on the volatility of the assets themselves. So what should be the standard haircut for a type of security on the platform? So what should be the standard haircut for treasuries, for equities, for corporate bonds, things like that? My understanding would be that if two counterparts are in a repo transaction and the haircut is being raised because of credit concerns by the lender on that, that probably would still be something negotiated between those two parties and probably wouldn't be publicized. Again, I'm just speculating there. But that's, I know that most of the work that I've seen done has really centered not so much on how do we look at the counterpart for the haircut, but how do we look at the type of collateral for the haircut.
Norm, this is Tom Krebs. Do you know the names of the New York Fed personnel that are members of that task force?
The head of the task force for the New York Fed is named Lucinda Brickler, B-R-I-C-K-L-E-R.
Yeah, I think we're trying to talk to her tomorrow.
Yeah, we're speaking with her tomorrow, then, I'm informed.
She's very good, and we are part of that task force. We had there was a workshop that the task force sponsored on February 3rd, just to kind of get ideas out there to the whole marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that we're hoping to have some actual materials to put together by the end of March, as far as some of the findings on some of the issues around the repo market. But Lucinda is probably your best person to talk to from the standpoint of the point person at the New York Fed.
Well, just so we appear a little bit more well-read tomorrow in our discussion with Lucinda, why don't you tell me what the issues are
and
with respect to the task force?
Look at and tell us how to talk
yeah.
to him.
I think that it'll be the same issues that they raised at the workshop would be the main areas that get hit. Talking about the market itself from the standpoint of how do haircuts get set, as we talked about. Talking about different ways of providing liquidity in the case that there is a failure on the platform and collateral needs to be taken possession of. By the lenders on the platform and how you would go about doing that. And again, I think at the workshop, the group representing that presented a number of ideas on how to proceed with that. and those are still being discussed within the group overall, and no consensus has been reached on exactly how you go about doing that.
I believe there's also a link on the New York Fed's website that can bring you to a document that summarizes some of this, and we can maybe forward that on to you if we can find it.
That would be
right now. I can probably actually give you that website if you give me a second here. So
sure.
If you have any questions, go ahead, and I'll look while we're talking.
Yeah, and my next question had to do with settlement risk for J.P. Morgan and Bank of New York Mellon. Is that a real issue or a real risk?
I guess the settlement risk is kind of throwing me there a little bit.
Well, let's suppose that we've got an overnight repo, and somebody pulls their repo the next morning, doesn't renew it, and then they go to get the collateral, but the collateral may not be sufficient necessarily to cover the amount. Is that a real possibility or not?
It is a possibility. I think the collateral is priced on a daily basis, but markets move, and markets move when there are big events. They move in a more volatile way. So if there was a bankruptcy, there's certainly a potential that an underlying collateral, if seized and you try to sell it, might not be sold. For the price that it was marked at that night, and therefore you potentially might have a loss. I mean, that is the risk when you enter into repo transactions.
So is that a risk that Boney or J.P. Morgan would bear? I mean, I guess my question is, so are they just a collateral agent? So in this case that Tom was giving you, the repo's not rolled over, then do they have to deliver 100% of the money that was provided, or do they just have to deliver the collateral that they were holding?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things. I think one of the areas that you're getting at is some of the work that the New York Fed Task Force is right now working through is the fact that every morning, the way the mechanism works in tri-party repo, the tri-party bank unwinds all transactions first thing in the morning, sometime between 7 and 8 o'clock, and rewinds the trades up at the end of the day when everything has rolled. In the interim of the day, they're kind of on the hook for the counterparts, for the dealers that are financing themselves. So if there was an intraday failure of a counterpart, it is a tri-party bank that potentially could be exposed to that. There's a lot of work in the task force that's being done to try to limit that exposure or potentially eliminate that exposure, and that would then bridge the gap throughout the day where the investor maintains exposure to the counterpart.
That's one of the initiatives neglected to mention that's being worked on by one of the subcommittees. This whole idea of just keeping exposure on throughout the 24-hour period with the borrower on the platform, so that these trades don't wind and unwind and reduce exposure to the tri-party banks themselves, which is one of the concerns of the Fed. And so there's been a fair amount of work done on that as well.
Let me take you back to September of 2008, and you describe for us in your own words what you saw happening when Lehman crashed.
So,
and what repercussions did it have? I mean, for example, we know now that the Reserve Primary Fund broke the buck. Did that have any impact on you? Were people fleeing money market funds? What did you have to do?
Yeah, well, I think, so if you're speaking of the week of the 15th, Lehman files for bankruptcy very early in the morning or around midnight on the 14th, so-called early September 15th, the markets were taken back. We saw the stresses that happened at the reserves. They had some unsecured exposure to the parent company of Lehman Brothers. That became impaired. Their shareholders got very nervous, started pulling a lot of money out of their funds. At that point, we did not experience significant shareholder, but at think once the baby had, they had a problem and they no longer were going to be able to pay out their shareholders a dollar a share, then, you know, we did see some contagion across the whole industry where there was, a lot of, I think there were a lot of nervous shareholders who were redeeming specifically on the institutional side.
What was your reaction to that? What did you do? You paid them, but how did that impact your trading?
Well, you know, we had it was interesting to watch the mix of assets, to be honest with you, or the mix of shareholders. We had, as Kevin said, we had shareholders who are institutional shareholders, and they seemed to be most nervous and most likely to pull money out of our portfolios. And then we had retail shareholders, which make up a large majority of what we manage here.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually, during that week, saw money come into those, and especially into our treasury and our government funds, they came in. From a trading standpoint, it made it difficult in those markets because there just wasn't enough supply to do what you needed to do, so that got priced down pretty significantly. But shareholders really weren't concerned about yield. They were concerned about ultimate, just getting safety. So we saw money coming in from outside of Fidelity, we assume, coming out of banks or coming out of other places where they just wanted to seek out more security and went into our government funds. But even our other retail funds, money market funds, or general purpose funds, saw growth in them as well as the week went on. The institutional funds did see cash leaving. We had tried to prepare for that. We saw the markets were somewhat early, nervous, so we did have a fair amount of cash built up in those portfolios, and were able to meet all the redemptions that came to the funds.
How much was the redemptions you had?
I honestly don't remember what the total was that we had during that week, to be honest with you, Scott. I don't know if you have any information on that.
We can probably get more precise numbers, but I think we probably saw over the course of several weeks, like many other funds, probably a third of assets go out. That's a guess, but there were some pretty significant flows.
Yeah. And again, I think that's probably a good guess. But again, let me just clarify. That was a third of the assets on the institutional side.
And there's a very important distinction here that is often lost, because why would people think about this normally? All 2A7 funds are not created equally, and all taxable funds are not created equally. The biggest risk for liquidity at the time, and maybe today, were those institutional shareholders, the corporate treasurers who had cash in the bank, except it wasn't in the bank, it was in a money market fund, and they were trying to make a payroll in another month or two or three, and they were not interested in having a conversation about why their money was safe. Somebody up the line told them, get that money out of there, put it in a bank, put it somewhere else, let's make sure we're not going to get caught as the next entity that couldn't get cash out. And there was a period of time in which money market funds across the industry were having direct conversations with investors, posting holdings every day to try to reassure the marketplace that that we had the investments that were appropriate and that a dollar would be a dollar. So that was a relatively small focus of the marketplace. It was what we call prime funds, or funds that are either AAA rated or really intended for that institutional marketplace. But other investors, retail investors, largely speaking, didn't really get panicked. They didn't move their money. They let the products work the way they were supposed to.
So when you talk about your institutional customers, I mean, who are they usually? Are they corporations mostly?
It varies, but among them are big corporations, corporate treasurers, yeah.
Do you think that the scare or the reason why perhaps some of those corporate shareholders were pulling money out of their money market funds was because they had perhaps lost access to the commercial paper market?
Because because those investors in our money market funds had lost access to the commercial paper market themselves?
Yes.
I don't know.
That's an interesting question.
About a week after Lehman, that market seized up and damn near disappeared, and people were really scared. I mean, they were pulling on their lines of credit. They were trying to get cash assembled wherever they could for fear that that market was significantly in peril. And I was just wondering if you had thought that perhaps that was one of the driving forces behind the withdrawals of funds from your money market funds.
That very well could be. You're absolutely right in how you characterized the market at that time. You know, the entire short-term market for a brief period there really did seize up in so many ways, and it was difficult transacting. So, yeah, it's possible that corporate treasurers were looking for cash anywhere they could find it.
At the outset of this discussion, I think it was Mr. Lynn who might have said that he had some Norm who had some experience in the commercial paper area. Did y'all see that? Did you see what happened to the commercial paper market in or on or about the time of the Lehman failure?
I think there became a lot of concern. What happened during that time was that the same thing happened to every participant in the market itself. This, be it the money market funds, be it any participant, cash became king. Everybody just really tried to marshal their cash as best they could. Nobody really wanted to commit cash to any type of investment in particular, unless it was very short term, because people were just nervous about needs for cash. I think you hit it on the head with the corporate treasurers and people like that. They were looking to hang on to their cash because they weren't sure if they would have access to their normal places of getting it. You know, for us as money market funds, we tried to be very prudent and keep cash on hand just in case shareholders wanted redemptions and needed cash for any purposes. Overall, the market itself did have a hard time funding itself for a few days there, and it did freeze up to some extent, as I think it's been well documented. It was a period I wouldn't want to go through again as an investor in the marketplace, because the whole market was feeling very nervous and skittish at that point.
Well, I mean, it was a little bit more than that. These guys apparently, I mean, yours were short-term liquid investments in these money markets, and they wanted it close to home and in their local banks, I presume. They were a little bit more fearful than that. But that's another subject that at some point we would like to talk to y'all about what you saw in that commercial paper market and what you thought, if you have any notions about the impact that it had. For example, we have testimony, or will have testimony, from certain CFOs who will say they might not have been able to buy inventory. They might not have been able to continue to produce weapons for our troops. Walt Disney may not have been able to open because of the collapse of the commercial paper market. But for the actions of the Fed, they were running, sending their wives to the ATMs to get cash.
It was a very nervous period. And I can certainly bring in some people that we talked about the commercial paper market itself and how we saw it and how we transacted in it. But it was, there was a couple of days there where it became very difficult to access any kind of short-term credit. There's no question about that. And it just was, the overall market was just nervous to commit capital anywhere. And it took a couple of days, and it took some government action to make people more comfortable again.
I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your offer to give us some guidance on the commercial paper, because, I mean, oftentimes I feel like I'm one of those guys trying to figure out what an elephant is who's a blind man. But
this whole market is... It is complex, but it's truly fascinating, and it really is an interesting market. And it is operated so efficiently and so well for so long that when we do hit a bump in the road, like we hit, and it was more than a bump, we were hitting a wall there for a while. It really gets your attention and makes you realize how important this market is.
Tell me what it felt like to be approaching and then hit that wall.
It was not. I've been with Fidelity for 23 years, and so I've been in the financial markets, and I've managed bond funds in the municipal market. I've managed money market funds, and before taking on the job as a head trader, and it was that period there, and it's been interesting sharing war stories with my counterparts at other firms similar to ours, or on the street, or anybody you talk to in the financial markets. It was probably the most frightening period that we've lived through,
over that past 20 years, just from the standpoint of so much uncertainty in the marketplace at that time as far as exactly, you know, how the market is going to resolve itself and work through some of the issues that it had. So, you know, I think there's no surprise there. It's been well documented. There's been a lot of articles, papers, books published about it. I'm sure there'll be a lot more in the future. But it was really a unique type of moment for the financial system in our country, you know, one that we were happy to get through and move forward on. I can tell you this, and this is just anecdotal from my standpoint here. I remember sitting on a conference call that week, and we had the head of our, you know, a couple of people who represented senior management in our company, and people represented all the different areas of our company. And at that moment, it made me really happy to be part of a large company like ourselves, because we had the resources to work through it. The entire focus was on how do we get money to shareholders who need it? How do we make sure the funds function as they should? And, you know, the commitment was totally there. And it sounds funny to say this, but, you know, at that moment, as nervous as the market felt and as frightening as the market felt at that point, I was really proud to be at Fidelity and the way we handled things. And I'm sure people felt that at other firms around the country as well. But it was a really good moment, you know, for us, because I thought we handled it well, we did what we needed to do, and it was one of the toughest times the financial markets have faced. So, you know, from that standpoint, it was a positive I take from it, but I would take never going through that kind of period again.
Well, Fidelity's reputation precedes it. I mean, we have the greatest respect for you and for that entity. But understand, one of the things we're trying to do is to try to take this complex issue that you work with on a daily basis and explain it to the American people and to the President and to Congress in ways that they can understand it and in ways in which they can see if in fact it is true that we came quite close. There are certain people who say we did. How do you feel? How close do you think we came? Did you think you were close to the brink?
Through like a total financial meltdown, and we were closing up shop as a country, or
well, as an economy. As an economy.
No, I didn't. I knew that it certainly felt like a very tough period. It was like I said, it was the toughest period I've worked through in my career. I never felt like the economy itself was shutting down. It was a short-term financial crisis, and I recognized that. I think part of what helped for me was having been in the municipal business for so long and watching, you know, previous financial crises, certainly nowhere near this scale, but, you know, thinking back on the experience that I had and knew about from when New York City, you know, had their financial crisis, when Cleveland was working through a financial crisis, Philadelphia, some of the cities there, you knew the cities were still going to be there 5, 10, 20 years from now, and certainly a week from now and 2 weeks from now. The problem was, how are you going to get to tomorrow? And that was the issue that we were dealing with at that point. So it was very similar on a much larger scale to those situations where you knew that short term you had this financial crunch and this market that was not functioning as it should. But you still had confidence that long term everything was still going to work because all the fundamentals were still there.
Well, what do you think caused the crisis, Norm?
I think that overall it came down to a crisis of confidence in the market itself. I think people just got nervous, and the short-term market, you know, all of our markets in any capitalist market to a large extent is going to deal on confidence. Do we have confidence in the system itself? Do you have confidence ultimately, you know, you think about things like you have confidence in the dollar and the fact that it's backed by the government. And I think people maintained confidence at that larger level. But I think for a period of time there, the short-term confidence of where can I invest safely and know that I'm getting my dollars back tomorrow when I need them, I think for a period of time there was a loss of confidence in that, and people were just a little bit afraid. That to me was a large part of it. That there was just a loss of confidence in the short end of the market that caused the specific crisis that we're talking about here, which was those days in September when it felt like the short-term market was ceasing to exist. There was obviously larger forces at work that brought us to that
point, and you know, had been building over the, you know, in 2007, 2008, and I'll leave it to greater minds than I to explain exactly why that all happened and how it happened. But at that point in time that we're kind of talking about right now, there was a crisis of confidence in the market overall, and you know, in so many ways, the system did work as it should. We have a Federal Reserve, we have a structure to our government that's there for a reason, and I was proud of the way they reacted in this too. You know, I think when you talk to Lucinda and those people, you know, we were in contact with people at New York Fed, you know, every day as they were talking about what's going on in the market, asking questions, the same kind of questions you're asking now, you know, they were asking in real time as far as how are things functioning, how are the markets going. And I was overall, to be honest with you, as many snowballs being thrown at them in this winter, I thought that the Treasury and the Fed did a lot of the right things to restore that confidence, and they recognized that that confidence needed to be restored, and got us over that hump and got us back to a functioning market.
Now, did this crisis reveal vulnerabilities, weaknesses in the way the repo market had developed that, you know, that I guess are being addressed since then? For instance, were haircuts not reflecting risk, and were there things that were allowed in as collateral that should never have been allowed as collateral?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think that it has caused our counterparts. We've spent a lot of time talking with them and people on the street. It has caused them to rethink how they finance themselves and be more balanced in how they finance themselves. The fundamental root of so many different crises in the past, the ones I touched on from a municipal standpoint, but also financial crises that we've had as well, have largely stemmed from, you know, you do have imbalances on the assets that you're investing in and how you're investing yourself. And those markets work very efficiently for long periods of time, but if they invert or become imbalanced, it is not a model that works as efficiently as it should. So I think that, you know, what was happening was the short-term market was financing a lot of the leverage that was going on with the street. The rules have been changed in the previous years on how much leverage they could have. You had a large amount of leverage in the marketplace buying assets that weren't necessarily the most liquid, and financing them in a very short-term market that could, you know, shrink fairly quickly. And I think that was the root of the crisis. The role the repo market played in that was that, you know, it existed as a short-term financing vehicle along with a lot of other short-term financing vehicles available to those who were choosing to leverage themselves.
Any more?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Len.
So we're trying to hone in on some of the triggers here. Can you elaborate, and maybe this is a, you know, better question for your credit department, but can you elaborate as to specific indicators that your credit department examines in determining that counterparty is a minimal credit risk as per the SEC?
I think my research directors would shoot me if I took a shot at explaining how they do their job. But again, that's another group that you know, we'd be happy if that's something that you'd like to spend some more time discussing. Be happy to bring those people that can give you a much better educated answer than I can on exactly how we think of that process and the evaluations that we do.
We very much would appreciate that.
We can do that same time we do the commercial paper discussion,
yes,
if you'd like.
In the meantime, can you perhaps speculate as to whether this is standard practice across the industry, or maybe you guys enjoy a little privileged access to credit research because of your size and resources?
I wish we had some kind of privileged access, but I can't say that we do. You know, the regulations in place require our counterparts to distribute the information evenly to everyone out there. So, you know, we get on the phone and talk with these guys, but we're very, very sensitive to making sure that we don't get any kind of information that is material or non-public. So, you know, that's really important for us to do. And I think we do a really efficient job of doing that. Scott and his entire legal staff has hammered that home to us enough that I think we understand that. And it's important to us because if we get in a situation where we have information that we're not comfortable with, we can't transact, and it freezes up the marketplace. So
I wouldn't say that our size gives us any particular advantage from an information standpoint. I think our size gives us an advantage from the standpoint of we have a large staff here, we have a lot of analysts, we have a lot of people spending a lot of time combing the market, looking for opportunities, and analyzing credits that we transact with, and that's probably where our size gives us the advantage, is just the manpower that we can bring to bear on the overall investment process.
So it'd be fair to say that you guys might be a little better at processing information that's publicly available?
I hope that we have people who have experience in the marketplace that enables them to use that experience to evaluate what's available in the market and make decisions and are really good, strong investors.
So I've got one question. So as you know, we're tasked with looking into the causes of the financial crisis. And based on what you've been saying, we're trying to figure out, where the repo market fits in here. Would you say it's accurate that, the repo market was involved in causing the financial crisis to the extent that it was a way to provide short-term financing for a longer-term, more illiquid assets, and then the freezing up in the repo market and the commercial paper market is really more of an effect of the commercial of the financial crisis rather than a cause of the financial crisis?
I wouldn't say that the repo market was a cause of the financial crisis from the standpoint of the way that it functioned. I think it functioned very efficiently overall. I think that the cause of the financial crisis will be in how the firms leveraged themselves, the types of investments that they made longer term, and the way that the mortgage market unraveled and impacted a large portion of the financial market overall. For us, it was really an interesting viewpoint to sit here and watch. We are on a trading floor where we have all of our fixed income investments represented, and it was like watching a tsunami sweep across an entire trading desk or a financial market in miniature. You watched in the mortgage market, and you saw traders, portfolio managers, analysts becoming concerned about what was happening in subprime and what the impact of that was. That was very interesting and interesting to watch, but you weren't sure exactly how that played through, and I wish I'd been smart enough to understand how it all would play through. And then you realize that the exposures they had in subprime could surface themselves in other types of structured vehicles that were out there that hit the insurers in particularly very hard. The insurers were such a huge part of the municipal market, making up about 50% of the market there. Talk about the MBIAs and the FIDCs of the world, that when they started to have real financial problems and lose their AAA standing because of the exposures they had in this mortgage market, it suddenly caused a dearth of supply and deteriorating credit quality for a lot of the participants in the municipal market. And suddenly our money market funds in the municipal area had fewer investments to get involved in. Our bond area was being much more cautious about the market overall because of what was happening there. And it was like this rolling tsunami that you watched hit each of these markets in ways that in retrospect make some sense, but in the moment were a little harder to predict. So for me, I wouldn't say that the repo market created a crisis. It seemed as though to me it was a lot of the longer-term investments that were being made by people who did use the repo market to finance themselves. Mm-hmm. But it was in these long-term instruments that ended up not having the value that they had when they were purchased or the value they were hoping they would have over time that caused a real hole in the balance sheet of some of these big institutions out there.
And I would agree with Norm that I certainly wouldn't think the repo market is the cause of the problem. I do think that the short-term markets, including the repo market, is where you'll see some of the problems surface first, because that's where these institutions rely on for a lot of their funding. And once the market starts to lose confidence in you, that might be one of the first areas where you see you see the problems, because they're having trouble funding those short-term investments that they rely on every day.
Hey, that's fair.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
Anything else? Gentlemen, I cannot tell you how much we have enjoyed this and how much I think we've learned of it. about it and about this particular market. Norm, Scott, Kevin, we very much appreciate it. And with Scott's permission, we may want to direct some questions after we've had an opportunity to study a little bit about the very good, the wealth of information you've given us, and to pose some additional questions. Additionally, to the extent that you could get, as I told you, our biggest issue right now is finding the size of this market. And oh, there's one more question. Various folks like Sheila Bair, Mary Shapiro, a number of experts, including Gary Gorton and others, have said that there is this shadow banking system out there that exists beyond regulation. And I certainly gleaned from your discussions about the SEC and the regulations specifically applicable to your money market mutual funds that you don't consider yourselves part of that shadow banking area. Is that right?
I think that's correct. We're working through new regulations that the SEC, Mary Shapiro and her team, have put together further regulate, you know, how we manage our process. And, you know, we're very comfortable working within those regulations. They do determine how we make decisions in the marketplace, but no, we don't feel like we're part of any kind of a shadow system at all. We feel like we hope we're pretty well integrated into the conventional financial system, and we certainly are, regulated by the SEC, and we have responsibilities therein.
Well, you raised a question. What was the regulatory framework in which you now find yourself significantly different than what it was in 2008?
The framework is the same. We're still governed by the. The SEC still has oversight on us, and we still work in the rules that the SEC provides. What they did was they revised Rule 287, and Rule 287 is what governs how a money market fund needs to be run to qualify as a money market fund. And they did things like they shortened up the days to maturity that we can have in our funds. They put requirements on how much liquidity a money market fund is required to have on a one-day and seven-day basis, and then other changes as well. So the regulatory framework hasn't changed, but some of the rules have.
The other thing that's changed is the independent broker-dealer model doesn't exist the way it did.
Yeah.
That's right. It's a great point. That model is gone now with everyone essentially becoming a bank.
Do you perceive that those regulatory changes have been good for the money market mutual fund area?
Yeah, you know, there were some areas of the new regulations that we didn't fully agree with. We wanted to see a differentiation between institutional funds and retail funds as far as how much liquidity you needed to have, and I think we gave you a good example of that as far as what had happened in 2008 and where we saw the cash leaving, where we actually saw cash coming in.
Uh-huh.
But they decided that they would just do it kind of a one-size-fits-all and have one liquidity requirement for all the portfolios. So, you know, that was an area we had submitted our recommendations to the SEC and had discussions with them and had a fair hearing with it. There were pieces of it that we would have, if we had our druthers, we might have changed a little bit. But overall, I think that, you know, the thing that they're trying to do, we're heading in the right direction and doing the right thing. So I can't overly disagree with what they did and the actions that they took in the new release.
Yeah, the place that we, can I just jump in? I agree with
sure.
that, Norm. And the thing that we are more concerned about is the ruminations that there's another round of rulemaking out there that, among other things, might require money market funds to float the NAV, which would mean that you put a dollar in today, you might or might not get a dollar tomorrow, maybe get a dollar one, maybe get 99 cents. And we think that the stable NAV feature of our product is integral to its success, and that the assets that we've gathered, the $500 billion that Norm mentioned, is really, we help lubricate the markets. We think we are a positive force within the markets, and that if you floated the NAV, if the SEC came along and said we're no longer going to allow money market funds to use a dollar as the NAV for the fund, that those assets would go to any one of a number of other places, banks, which maybe are already too big, or some people think that they are, offshore, or to other unregulated pools of money that have less oversight. So we're not, to sort of follow up on Norm's point, we think the SEC might have done some things a little bit differently at the margins from what we would have done, but we think this is a good, these are good developments overall. We're a little bit more concerned about what happens next.
Well, I mean, in light of the fact that the government came in and provided, you know, support, unprecedented support to the industry, does the solution involve some kind of permanent liquidity support, either from the government or from somebody else?
Yeah, well, we've talked about, I mean, that's certainly one of the things that you hear people talking about. The question that we may never know the answer to, and I don't know that anybody will. Maybe this is, maybe we'll wait to read your report, the commission's report, is that to the extent that the lender of last resort needed to step in across broad swaths of the market, and money market funds certainly had that benefit, are the changes to 2A7 and some of the other reforms that are in place enough to put us in a place where the markets function appropriately again? And to the extent you're going to, that lots of solutions get layered on top of each other, I think we'll all look back in 10 or 15 years, regardless of what the policy choices are, and look at one or two or three of those reactions and say, well, this one worked and that one didn't, and here's how these two or three things reacted together in ways we didn't foresee. So we're not suggesting that there aren't incremental changes that ought to be made. Fidelity probably hasn't even formulated the policy, but when I think about this, I think there are incremental changes. Some improvements have already happened, like the changes to 2A7. We'd like to see those changes take effect and start to see what's happening before we layer on more reforms.
Good. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for an articulate explanation and a seemingly extraordinarily well-informed one. And I cannot thank you enough.
So can I just add one or two more things before we...
Oh, absolutely. Have at it.
Just one thing that had caught our attention was Professor Gorton had put together a question and answer piece prepared for your commission that talked about the repo market and used the terms as was said before about the shadow banking system.
And I was referring to him when I've said other authorities. Oh. Yes, I'm aware of that.
And I have to admire any paper that actually up front quotes Foghorn Leghorn, one of my true heroes there. But there was a couple of issues I just wanted to mention because I just think it's kind of important.
Yes, please.
In there, he talks about how oftentimes people are looking for a place to house short-term investments while they're looking for longer-term investments. And he talks about money market funds using repo as kind of a place to just put short-term cash as we look for other investments that are out there. And I just want to highlight to you, and hopefully it's highlighted by, what Kevin was saying about our having $150 billion in the repo platform. It's an important investment for us, and we look at it that way. You know, we look at that as an investment in J.P. Morgan, right, or in Bank of America, or the counterparts that we have there. You know, we look at it as very solid, short-term, liquid investment available to us for shareholders, and we have a very broad base of shareholders, institutional, retail, over 9 million shareholders represented on that platform, and so we're looking to maintain a lot of liquidity. It's been a great platform for us from that standpoint. So for us, it's not just a short-term mechanism to put our cash in, like a checking account, which is the example you'd use for institutions. It really is an investment that we do use. And then the other two things I just want to mention was, as you said, it's very difficult to come up with what the size of the market is. I know he's trying to think of this holistically, what the entire market might be size, as opposed to what we're talking about, the primary dealers. But $12 trillion does seem kind of large to us. And, but it is very tricky to come up with that.
Well, I agree. That's an extraordinary amount, and I've just got to believe he's double counting somewhere there.
Yeah, I think so too, and especially, you know, that we're looking at what we think of such a large market where the New York Fed is concentrating their efforts, which is on the tri-party platform, and the New York what's under New York purview is about a $2 trillion platform right there by itself. And the last thing I just want to highlight was one thing he said in the paper was that prior to the crisis, haircuts were zero. And that was never the case. You know, there's always been haircuts. Again, they haven't been put in place on the tri-party platform, and the types of transactions we're involved in are necessary to ensure yourself some cushion in case of having to take the collateral. It's more for the pricing, day-to-day pricing movements that happen within it, making sure that you have a cushion, that you stay fully collateralized. So that's just a couple of things I just wanted to point out in the paper itself and make sure that you had our viewpoint on that as well.
Unfortunately for Professor Gorton, he doesn't have subpoena power. We will be able. I think we will be able to come to a number. Yeah, and to that end, we covet your continued cooperation and help because this has been very helpful to us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And gentlemen, if we can help you, just give us a scream. We're easy to find here in D.C.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, gents. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Great.